now 9:05, so I'm suggesting that we start. I do recognize the fact that there was a bit of a gridlock even this morning, and my biggest concern always are for the members that come from the accommodation, and at times to struggle to come in. So I can always be guided if we actually need to start at 9:30 and not at 9, but that's really, I'll be guided by more the members that are actually staying at the residences of Parliament, but that's for the future. Let me then just get clarity. Did we receive any apologies, Anele? Excuse me? Okay. So Ms. Dudley apologized. Okay. If not, anyone else? Whoop from our side? Okay. Good. I think we normally do have a quorum, and this therefore becomes a engagement with the Development Bank of South Africa. And as I've indicated to the members, that as a committee on higher education and training, we do know that there are different research taking place in this country and across the continent and the world, that we, as a committee, we need to try and learn from that, understand the current debates, the current trajectory around education, but also appreciate the fact that the fourth parliament were constituted through a process of engaging with the electorate, and the political parties that have fought the election in fact have brought forward different manifestos, and always I hope that in this committee that there's going to be always more synergy, and I've seen it playing itself out. Synergy with various views, but with a common responsibility of appreciating the fact that we need all to work to a better, capable education system in this country, meaning there are serious weaknesses. And therefore we felt it important that to invite the DBSA. So I just want to say to Graham Block, welcome. And also thank you for availing yourself the day when I was put in the position of chairperson, a day or two thereafter. I've sent and tried to make contact with a few individuals, and Graham Block was one of those individuals. Knowing that the Development Bank of South Africa has done this type of research, you would also remember, members, that I indicated that we want our committee to become specialists in their own right. Doesn't mean we're all going to be professors and doctors, etc. But in our own little way, we want to be specialists when it comes to our education and training. And find our niche so that 12 months from now, the individuals around our committee table would be able to say, this is how I capacitated myself in the context of higher education and training. And the DBSA has done extensive work. Graham, but really thank you for the role that you've played historically in South Africa, and trying to drive the agenda of a quality education system. The committee is quite clear that we've taken a decision in our workshop a while ago that there are serious weaknesses with the education system currently. We've analyzed the students at higher education level. We've analyzed, we've had a meeting a week ago with Higher Education of South Africa, and its FAS was in that meeting. We're clearly not happy with the 45% on average dropout rate when it comes to higher education. But the same with the further education and training. There was a research done in the Western Cape with certain FETs. Now, some of the research in that nationally around FETs, the benchmarks, a lot of those benchmarks at times comes from some of the IFIT colleges or campuses this year. But we've seen serious weaknesses. I mean, like I saw yesterday when I was reading, a 20% pass rate at many FET colleges, vocational training, etc., which is a serious problem. And then we've got the reality of the mass number of people that the minister raised, unemployed, unemployable, not appropriate skills. At least 2 million plus, and what do we need to do about all of that? Now the statements that I've just indicated to you were stuff that the president also put in his State of the Nation address, as well as the national minister raised in his budget address. All of that comes out of particular research done over the last year and more, and I think, Graham, that is why we've invited yourself to this meeting to share some of those realities, and then we'll be able to interact with yourself and just see how we can take this research forward, whether Parliament convenes a debating forum, whether there's dialogue required on some of these issues. But how do we bring, if we speak about a skills revolution, how do we bring it into the center of every person, but not only in the corridors of power, but also amongst the ordinary people. But that's over to you, Dr. Block.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the doctorate, which I haven't been awarded yet. But I would take the doctorate from the committee, which is far more important. No, but thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chair. And thank you also...
You're Mike. Thank you also to Anele for organizing the session. Let me just clarify the documents that I've been handing out. The one is this one here, the education roadmap, which I think all of these, they are copies. And it's the actual narrative report from the DBSA, and perhaps the most importantly includes at the end the 10-point program, which is really a summary of a process that I'll talk about. And then the slides, which I will run through, but I think there's also copies of the slides that you can just take that with you and make notes. And then finally, the actual presentation that I will give. And just to say, Chairperson, that I think this presentation probably gives a bit of a background to the HESA report that we've all been reading about young people who are arriving at universities unprepared. And this explains what's going on mostly in the schools, because the education roadmap is a focus on the school system. But once I've managed to convince you that I know something about the school system, I'll make a few remarks on how the higher education system and the skills training system seem to relate to this and what we can learn from the roadmap. So let me get going straight away. And I really will just be following this. We must give our children a start, a firm foundation, so that they can go confidently into this world. In a spirit of democracy and human solidarity, they can indeed create the kind of world that we all imagine is possible. Education, as we know, is seen as the root out of poverty in any society, and very many heavy demands are put on it. Education change in any society is extraordinarily complex. And let me just in brackets, and then I'll stop doing brackets to the input piece, but just say that in the United States, they just spent the last, I think it's decades, doing something called No Child Left Behind, focusing on maths and science, or maths and literacy skills in disadvantaged schools. And they've just done the report focusing enormous amounts of money. They've just done a report on the outcomes, and they actually found that children who didn't go through the No Child Left Behind report actually did better than children who went through No Child Left Behind. And they're not quite sure why and what that means, but it does just show that it's incredibly complex, and many examples of resources not achieving measurable or meaningful results all over the world. And I think we must understand that in South Africa, especially where their issues and imperatives of transformation as well, correctly, on top of the issues, it's going to be even more complicated and more complex. Teaching is indeed difficult, complex, multifaceted, and multi-layered, an art and a science. Now, education not only shows the route to development, but it also reproduces the problems and inequalities of any society. And it has these contradictory potentials to both show a way out, that it is a tried and tested route that enables individuals and societies to rise above historical circumstance and emerge from poverty. I want to make the point that schools cannot teach what we do not learn and see in our homes and communities. It's no good sending children to the finest schools if society around is teaching them to be bullies or not to value education or learning. And we saw recently in one of the better Model C schools in Johannesburg, where in fact parents backed the people who were doing the bullying. And parents sent their children to school with purple ribbons to complain about the child who'd laid charges against bullying. So, and there are many examples, and I hate to say in politics there are probably even more examples than even in the wider society of things that are said that just don't help build unity and a desire for skills. Now, you've already seen the education roadmap and some of the diagnoses and recommendations. And essentially, I think what the roadmap says is that South African schools are failing to perform. Resources, and really this is the diagnosis part here, results are amongst the worst in Africa. Some 30% of children in grade 3 or 6 perform at the level required for literacy or numeracy. And there was an article in yesterday's Cape Times where Duncan Hindel said the figure had gone up to 35%. And let me say, I don't think that indicates anything at all. The reality is that all international tests show that our children are just not getting it. And certainly not enough, even if it's 35% and not 30%, not enough to compete and lead in a harsh international climate. So where are the skills and the outcomes that a developing democracy like our country requires? But more than just the actual outcomes, I'm not sure if somebody can help me with how to get the... Well, you'll see I'm on the diagnosis there under very poor outcomes. But more than the outcomes, well, 50% or more of white children go on to university. The corresponding figure for black children is only 12% going to university. Half of all children drop out before they even reach matric. 62.5% of grade 3s here in the Western Cape, which is supposed to be the better province, 62.5% of kids in the formal Model C schools could do maths at the appropriate level, which is not great. It's only two-thirds. But the corresponding figure for the township schools was 0.1%. Just to repeat that, 62.5% against 0.1%. Another way of saying it, 1 in 10 white kids get an A-level pass in matric. Only 1 in 1,000 black kids gets a matric A pass. Now, such inequalities are unsustainable in a democracy seeking redress. And the fact that they take on a racial dimension makes them even harder to accept. For most of our kids, school actually teaches them the hidden curriculum, the harsh lessons, that there's no hope and place in the hopes and dreams of the new society. Their aspirations vanish and disintegrate in the failure of our schools. We are failing our children and generations to come. Now, there are many reasons for this, and we should certainly never discount history and our terrible past. I don't agree. Sometimes the ministers of education say we must get over the past and we can't keep blaming apartheid, but I certainly think we have to understand how colonialism and apartheid demeaned education and the whole intellectual project in our land. Education was set up to control and not to liberate. We know the statements of H.F. Verwoerd, the architect of apartheid and Bantu education. He said, "Why should we show black people the green pastures in which they will not be allowed to graze?" Mathematics was virtually banned in black schools. Verwoerd said, "Why should we teach black children maths when they're not going to be allowed to use it?" And blacks should forever be hewers of wood and drawers of water, and education was to be part of the process of ensuring that. As I say in a book that I have just written that will come out in 2 weeks' time called The Toxic Mix, What is Wrong with Our Schools and How to Fix It, this history combines in a toxic mix that is very difficult and complex to change. The unsatisfactory outcomes of the past are reinforced by the policy and the implementation slippages of recent years. Last year's education roadmap, which was coordinated by the DBSA for the ANC as the incoming government, and I'll talk about it later. But it identified three levels that hold us back, and I really want to just talk to those three levels briefly. The first level, and the most important, is the level of in-class. What happens in the classroom where teachers and their learners interact? I hope Chairperson... No, let me not say anything. I'll talk about teachers later and what we expect from them. Where knowledge is shared, but it's in the classroom where knowledge is shared and an intellectual hunger for learning is created. And there's so many problems here, but undoubtedly teachers are the key. Both their discipline, but also how they support it, how they're trained, what they know, how they feel, how they're paid. Chairperson, if this was a classroom and I had to teach in a classroom like this with the amount of walking on, I would find it very difficult, to be honest. I'm sure the chair members here are used to concentrating, but I find it difficult with the amount of walking around, if I may be honest. So there's so many problems here, but teachers are undoubtedly the key. How they are trained, what they know, how they feel, how they paid and supported, and whether our young are inspired to see teaching as a noble profession it should be. What do people learn in the classroom when they come up against the teachers? The second level is the wider level, the level of support to school. What happens around the school? Are the schools resourced? Are there textbooks and materials? How does the principal manage the school? And how does she inspire her staff? So is the education department and the surrounding machinery, district machinery especially, geared to assisting the teachers in the classroom to do their fundamental task? And I would argue, and the research shows, that too many of our school districts fail to provide either pedagogical support, curriculum support, or administrative support that will enable our teachers to do what we expect of them. Too many of our officials see as their job making the schools fill in forms and comply with policy, while they fail miserably to do what civil servants should be paid to be doing in a developmental state. And I think obviously this committee probably has a really crucial role there in ensuring that civil servants do their jobs. And apart from civil servants not doing their jobs around the schools themselves, we have to say that most of our schools lack libraries or labs or computer facilities. I think it's 60% of our schools, probably higher, our secondary schools, don't even have computer facilities. And if you're not linked today to these kind of technologies, it's very hard to catch up. Labs, computers, sports fields, and even staff rooms, so that schools are not nice places to go and spend the day if you have to leave your home. And then, if I said in school, the support to school, what happens around the school, and then at the widest level, the social level, what happens in society. And there we have HIV/AIDS, child-headed households, just intestinal worms. Probably most kids in the rural areas, especially the ex-homelands, have just got worms and find it difficult to concentrate. Gangs and violence that we see every day, fetal alcohol syndrome, poor transport, hunger, overcrowding, all of these make it difficult for our children to learn. Apart from the fact that their parents are undereducated and struggle to help them and feel intimidated by teachers. And we don't have an ethos of being a learning nation that's looking confidently ahead. So the parents don't know if this is where they're supposed to be. And I think we're beginning to address that. I'll talk about that later. So enormous amount of things to fix, but we're not victims. I don't have to tell this committee that our past may be sad, but it is what we have. And we can wallow in our failures, or we can set our sights anew and decide to be the best that we can. In order to do this, we need a plan and a vision to hold together the multiple levels of intervention and coordination that are required. I suppose the point there, a learning nation in search of excellence. I do want to say that the department is right to say that there has been immense progress. We shouldn't undermine that. There is much to praise. The fact that we're able to run logistically a matric exam, get the papers out, set the exams, get all the papers in, mark them, usually get most of the results out on time, and so on, is an enormous logistical exercise. And it just shows that there are education departments with good plans, excellent officials, much experience, deep capability, who are committed to making a difference. But I think the point is that we need to focus on where the gaps and errors and problems are, because that's what we need to fix. Recently, the DBSA was asked to bring together a range of education stakeholders, and it included the Minister of Education, Naledi Pandor, the teacher unions, both NAPTOSA and SATU as the major teacher unions, not the only teacher unions. But I think important, Chairperson, that the ANC didn't just bring together narrowly ANC supporting organizations. Government officials, NGOs, again, I mean, just to give examples, there was Center for Education and Policy Development, which is an ANC supporting organization. There was also Center for Development and Enterprise, which is probably more hostile to the ANC, or more critical of the ANC, I should say, not hostile. And so it really was, if, if I may make some propaganda chairperson, it was the ANC at its best when it's very inclusive and doesn't see itself. It saw this as a wide program, bringing together academics and policy experts and so on, to develop a diagnosis and a set of solutions. And out of this came the 10-point program, which has been presented to the public for discussion, and it forms the core of a debate about where to go. Now, the 10 points identify particularly primary schools and early childhood development, which obviously in some ways seems far away from this committee, but it says that these are the base on which all else must rest. It also identifies the points about getting teachers in class, on time, teaching. And I think that's probably, again, that oversight role of laying down boundaries for teachers. But not just the boundaries, what we expect from teachers, but also support for teachers. And we have to confess there are many reasons why teachers have reason to feel unhappy and to find their tasks difficult. Maybe I'm just a bit of a... I think the public is probably ready to lynch a lot of teacher organizations if the phone calls to SAFM are anything to go by. But so I hope teachers, when I'm critical of them, realize that people like ourselves are probably being about as defensive as we can be without undermining our credibility. I'll just give you one example, Chairperson. Recently, SACE, which is the professional body for teachers, said that they would name and shame teachers who were found guilty of child abuse. And one of the teacher union's spokespeople in Gauteng said that this was terrible because of the impact on their careers and they would find it hard to get jobs again in the future. And, of course, his union was very reluctant to come down and say this is totally unacceptable. So not only the teachers and their unions, but also the districts and their officials. And too often, of course, the departments give excuses to the teachers. They don't pay transport on time. They often don't even pay the teachers on time. So teachers are able to say, well, how can we allow these people to monitor and supervise us if they can't even get their own job done? And so the roadmap talks a lot about getting management and district officials to do their job. And then the third point, the importance of social compacts and social initiatives of all kinds, political, community-driven, just driven by individual citizens and organizations. And I think the final 10 points and exactly what they say are not a Bible. It's less important, the actual points, than the fact that they're a package and the kind of challenge that they imply. But let me just say that I think it makes three important points that we can take over to the skills and even the higher education area. The first point is that we are all in this together. Any attempt to fix things will have to be a stakeholder-driven process and must be based on society-wide agreement. As the ANC slogan says, together we can do more. Secondly, we need to prioritize. We can't do it all. There is so much to fix. So we need to decide on where we start and what are the things that will have the most impact. And in order to decide on what those 10 or whatever number of things are, we need agreement on which will be the vital priorities. I don't think it's enough to just lay them down the line, but that's part of that stakeholder process and the national dialogue we need to decide what will be our priorities. And lastly, we need a plan and a vision. We need real tasks and we need a set of outcomes that we can pursue and measure to see if we have made progress. As Amilcar Cabral, that great African intellectual, said, we need a vision where we look to the sky, but with our feet firmly planted on the ground in the realities. And if I must... Maybe a very simple question, Chairperson, and one could ask it for high schools, but one could also ask it for higher education. If I said even to this committee and its members, what is the vision for higher education? What do we expect our universities to do? Where will they be in 5 years or in 10 years? I couldn't give you an answer, and I doubt whether you could give me an answer. And if you don't have that kind of vision, how do you get people working around individual plans? And as I say, even in high school, if I had to say, where are we going to be with maths, realistically, given the problems? When are we going to have 10% of our kids doing okay? When are we going to have 30%? In 5 years, in 10 years? There's no plan. And there's no vision. Now, the roadmap doesn't have all of the answers, certainly not in the detail that will eventually be required for clear targeting and outcomes. But I do think what we have in this country and at the moment is a space, a policy space, where many things are possible. Since the peaceful revolution at Polokwane, where Thabo Mbeki was democratically replaced by Jacob Zuma, and since the election where the masses of our people did deliver their choice and their verdict, education has risen to be a national priority of all the parties. Now, at DBSA, we've decided to do certain things based on our own skills and competencies, which we think can work in this policy space. So this Monday, we launched something called Education Conversations at University of the Free State, where Jonathan Jansen was the first speaker, Professor Jansen. On August the 31st at UCT, MEC Donald Grant from this province and Dr. Mampela Rampele will be speaking in the Education Conversation series. And certainly the committee and its members, we will circulate invites, but certainly if you want to pencil it in already, it's August the 31st, probably I think at about 6 p.m. at UCT. We should know the venue late today. And then we'll go to Gauteng with MEC Creasy towards the end of September, and then probably in the Eastern Cape in mid-October. And what we're trying to do in all of these is to get the conversation going, to bring people of concern, goodwill, and with interest and skills together to try and address our education problems and to talk about solutions. Secondly, apart from the conversations and our contribution, we have been working directly with MECs to ask what it is that we can do and how we can use our institution to better support government delivery, which is the core mandate of the DBSA and infrastructure and accountability. And we're still developing these plans, initially probably with Gauteng and Western Cape, and also in interaction with some of the more rural provinces. And then lastly, we think we can make some contribution to the processes of monitoring that are going on in the presidency and in the monitoring commission. And we're helping to draw up some of the criteria that would be used for monitoring. What indicators would be most helpful? Matric pass rates, grade 3 or 6 results, dropout rates. How do we focus on the issues at hand and measure whether we've made progress and what mistakes we need to improve on? I also want to claim, lastly, that the roadmap has helped give impetus to processes that were already underway. And it's a difficult claim to make, but recently the Teachers Development Summit saw a lot of very positive resolutions also about teacher training, which would impact directly on this committee. And I think it's helped to encourage the developmental side of teachers and their organizations. And then recently we saw a standoff in Soweto where the MEC Creasy in Gauteng, just over the June 16th period, essentially met with SADTU teachers who were on strike in Soweto and agreed that they would go back to school. The next day the union broke the agreement and the teachers broke the agreement immediately. And so the MEC went to the Premier, Mokonyane, and the Premier called a meeting of parents with the MEC for Police, the MEC for Education, because there was quite a bit of violence in the strike. And they basically told parents that this was completely unacceptable, that teachers should be in class. And one of the Rubicons that was crossed, I think, in this head-to-head was that the teachers' union, the subject chairperson, actually came into that meeting and told the teachers that teachers in a region are not allowed to go on strike without consulting the national, and that this was unacceptable. They needed to be in class. And it's certainly the first time I've heard the teacher union actually laying down that line. And I mean, I would say partly, as I say, I think the roadmap has helped to give impetus, but also the roadmap itself is built on the Polokwane resolution of teachers shall be in class on time teaching, which is why, Chairperson, maybe I was a bit taken with the walking around, that one wants to see, you want to walk into classes and see that teaching is happening, that people are not wandering around and there isn't disturbance, that we're focused on the task at hand. And I think most of the MEC's budget speeches, if one reads them as well, they're also prioritizing much more carefully, at least thematically, and I think many of the themes will be found in the roadmap and in the 10-point program. So we as DBSA feel that we are called to mobilize in this space. And I would imagine for not just the ANC members of this committee, but for all members, this would be an issue. If we're going to rest as DBSA, if we're going to wait for government to do it all, if we're going to simply moan and complain and blame, we will soon end up back where we are. We don't think this policy space will be open forever. We have a window of opportunity to really make a difference. we can set ourselves on a path of progress from which there will be no retreat. We do believe we all have a responsibility to open this window. We cannot be found wanting for the sake of our society and for our future generations. What do some of these thoughts mean in the arena of higher education? I want to stress it's just some thoughts, although we have looked at some of the issues, and I'm sure none of this will be new to the committee, so I'll go through it quite quickly. It's quite clear that universities have shifted demographically. There was a black intake of something like 190,000 children in 1993. We now have 450,000 or more black students in our universities. I think the figure is probably over 700,000 if we include the distance universities. That's probably where the difference is. HESA recently said in Parliament that some 65% of tertiary students are now black. Incidentally, this has not changed since 2003. It's quite interesting. In 2003, it was also around that figure. So I think the question, I sit on UCT Council, and one of the things we've noticed is that UCT has hit a kind of a ceiling, which for some, we don't understand what that issue is. And maybe it does relate to the fact that there are not enough students coming through the school system. Could be. So there has been much progress and many positive initiatives. I certainly would say university education is not in crisis in the same way that high schools are in crisis. But nonetheless, are we producing the skills that we need at university level? As a society, we are not producing the architects, the engineers, the accountants, or the teachers, or social workers, or change managers. Even, as I said, on the level of teachers, there's a very limited discourse coming from the teacher training colleges. And I mean, again, if you said to the teacher training colleges, what is the plan for teachers over the next 5 years or 10 years? Maybe they've got one, but it hasn't. I mean, this would, again, be something your committee could do, is call in the deans of the teacher training colleges and ask them what the plan is and why the public is not being engaged with it. Because how are they meant to encourage teachers? Or encourage their children to go into teaching? And I do think maybe the Teacher Development Summit will also add impetus to that. So we're not producing skills on the scale we need. Secondly, there are huge inequalities at tertiary level, just as at school level, not surprisingly. About 60%, I said earlier, 50%, but between 50 and 60% of white learners get to university, with about 12% of black learners. Even before you look at throughput, where largely it's black students who drop out faster than white students. If you look at management studies, for example, which would be an area where you would expect a lot of focus, for every 83 white students who get through in 5 years, there are about 33 black students who do it in the same period. And similarly in the humanities or the languages, for every 62 white students, there are only about 25 black students who avoid effective dropout. Now, the HSRC has said very starkly that government has decided that the cost of getting working class children into universities is too high. I think one of the first things that the Minister of Higher Education had to face was the question of students at UNISA not having money or claiming they didn't have money for their exams. And he took one look at the numbers of people and he multiplied by the amount of the 1,000 rand they would have to pay to write the exams, and he quickly went away from the problem and said, this is a serious problem, we have to find the money somewhere. And so I think that question that the HSRC asks in a really useful and quite short policy brief, saying, are we taking seriously what it actually does cost to get people to university? The major reason why dropout occurs is financial, despite the fact that NSFAS has expanded dramatically. And the reality is that NSFAS pays mostly fees, but many students struggle around food, around transport. If you live in Khayelitsha, to get to UCT is extremely difficult. I mean, you can imagine on a day like this. Then transformation in lecturing staff, researchers, and other teaching levels has been very slow. Most of the staff remains white. Now, the reasons for this are very complex. It's not going to be wished away by rhetoric, because it takes years to train people who are able to occupy these positions. We don't understand it. It's not going to be solved by simplistic rhetoric. We do need a complex plan to tackle the range of causes why bright, young, black graduate students don't want to go into university teaching. Maybe one of the reasons is that they're better paid options outside of universities. I would hate to earn I'm sure as a university professor, a parliamentarian there, I'm sure even as a parliamentarian probably does better than university. I may be wrong, but I suspect does better than a university professor would do in his his lifetime. But certainly university wages don't help encourage young black students to go into them. Are universities contributing to changing attitudes in our society? And the crude answer again has to be no, generalizing. The Sudeen report recently came out to show that at all our universities, particularly the white English universities, black people don't feel like they belong. Black people feel alienated. Whatever the reasons and whatever the complexities or the interpretations of the reasons, there's clearly a problem that does need to be dealt with. And then the last two points about universities. The mergers themselves, I think the mergers over the last few years, the reduction of universities from some 30-something to 23 institutions has been mostly managerial. It's been an administrative and technical process that has not necessarily improved the management and has not improved the ability of the universities and technical universities to position themselves and to understand their niche. Because the reality is University of Venda will not do successfully what University of Cape Town will do. And so what should University of Cape Town be doing for the country? And what should university, and how do we understand the different niche? And I think the mergers have been very technical things that have sometimes complicated the lives. We were in Limpopo recently and saw a branch of University of Tshwane in what used to be in Pieter Tief in Makgado. How do you run a university from Tshwane when you have a branch out in Limpopo? So, but it hasn't even improved management, the mergers. I don't think we can say that even that technical administrative exercise has resulted in better management. Now, one of the problems of academic freedom and autonomy, of which I'm a very strong supporter, and let me again just underline that the statement that came recently saying that if a vice chancellor was critical of a political organization, their funding would be looked at a university, is a dicey one if we're going to understand the importance of academic freedom. But I do think that the universities have to do more to show that they are engaging if they're going to win the support of the public. Many in the universities, not all, do think that academic freedom means you can just simply sit and comment from a distance rather than engage with the problem of the country. And for me, engaging means being the best. I don't see a contradiction between being linked to the social issues of the day and being excellent. And the example that we were talking about earlier with one of the members of your committee was, for example, the space science or biotechnology, that we have things to offer in this country about the genetic understanding of tuberculosis. Or we can look at the skies through the large array telescope in a way that they can't from the north. So it's indigenous, it's our contribution, but it's our contribution to world knowledge. And that's how one can both engage. It shows that engagement and excellence go together. They're not necessarily contradictory. In lacking, as I said right at the beginning, a clear vision for higher education, it's not surprising we cannot get a clear perspective on issues like curriculum change, excellence in achievement, appropriate funding levels, transformation, and so on. Let me just summarize then what I think some of the implications for skills in higher education. I'll go back and talk about skills a little bit later, but just to say some of the implications for higher education of the roadmap, which focuses mostly on schools, just to remind us of, firstly, that the actual process of finding solutions is important. Diagnoses and problems need to be found in an inclusive stakeholders process, which brings everyone on board who has something to contribute. This discussion needs to be honest, open, and solutions-oriented. Again, I keep on making these comments, and maybe it's just the sort of abusing the platform that you have given us, but I think the kind of input that the Minister of Higher Education has been making has been fabulous. He's been engaging publicly in a very strong fashion, and I have no doubt that the universities will be able to answer him, that he's not going to intimidate the universities into silence. But that kind of engagement really does help stakeholders provide answers and come on board. It doesn't limit participation. And so I think there is a way to have strong views, but also to be inclusive. Secondly, as we said before, you can't do everything. So what are the priorities? What would be the priorities in higher education? And what top interventions would have maximum benefit? Obviously, NSFAS, for example, and financial support. would be one obvious one. And lastly, again to repeat, we need a vision and a defining plan so that institutions and organizations and individuals can buy in and develop their contribution with clarity, with resources and support. And let me say, when I say a plan and a vision, I don't think it needs to be a limiting thing again. You know, you can have very tight central planning or very tight manpower planning, and we'll see in the skills arena that's part of what's landed us in problems. Or you can have a plan and a vision that enables people to get a good sense of how they come on board, so that society understands what is expected from the higher education sector and people can get on with the job. Now, many of the above comments could also, I'm coming to the end now, could also just as strongly hold in the skills arena. Despite much work, and if I just mention the areas, one can see why it's so complex. The CETA's qualifications framework, FET college recapitalization and curriculum reform, learnerships and artisan training, and very limited progress in workplace-based skills development. Business has a long tradition of making a lot of money and moaning a lot and doing very little on its own shop floor. Quite frankly, the sector is a mess in skills. There's very little coordination, less vision, and enormous depilating bureaucracy. If there's one lesson from the roadmap here in the area of skills, it is for bold and honest appraisal. Let's actually look at what's going on in the skills arena. Stop saying we've got a fabulous qualifications council, we've got all the CETAs. Are they working? And then are we willing to make drastic recommendations and to clean up in a way that may be required? We have this very strange thing in South Africa for a revolutionary country that we're very moderate about policy proposals. When things don't work, we tweak a little bit and we see if we can fix the sort of the sort of edges, but we don't actually decide institutions aren't working, do we want them? Now, skills training is utterly crucial, not just as a site which we need to do more of for first choice vocational careers, but also it provides important space for many dropouts from the current school and higher education system who can find a second chance based on key skills that the country needs. And as I say, I don't think we're even beginning to get that area right. Lastly, let us just praise the recent statements by President Jacob Zuma, in particular the meeting with school principals in KwaZulu-Natal. The President has explained why education is priority number one, as the tried and tested route out of poverty. He's argued why energetic principles and management can play a key role in education's renewal and turnaround. He has explained how we have many good policies, but they don't seem to hit the ground. He's warned recalcitrant teachers to exercise proper discipline and has promised extensive teacher support. And again, as I said, we need to set the example right from the top in class, on time, teaching. And we need to show that this is, as the President has said, he's not going to put up with lazy and poorly performing officials anywhere in the system. It will not be tolerated. And all of these points have been emphasized in the educational roadmap, but it's utterly crucial, this vision of the President, as a starting point for re-energizing the nation around education. And lastly, Chairperson, the very last point, I would like to thank the Parliamentary Committee for this opportunity to engage around some of these issues and obviously concerns you will raise. Your legal responsibility of oversight, but your public mandate to raise issues and to find solutions are extremely important in the process. And it really is exciting to see this Parliamentary Committee taking these responsibilities very seriously. We are very grateful to be invited to play a part in these processes, and certainly as the Development Bank, we do look forward to future cooperation with your committee in whatever ways you might feel could be mutually beneficial to us. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Block and Dr. Block. Let me also welcome the members, I think three members that have just joined, and apologies to the presenter because he did raise it twice about the walking around. And it was literally because as members came in that our staff had to just make sure that they are capacitated with the documentation. But yeah, at some stage in my life, I was just teaching 2.5 years, and I know what that feels like as well. But apologies, Graham. Members, we got the presentation. I think the extract the roadmap literally talked about the schooling side, and there's a 10-point plan into that. There's implications on higher education, and in one of those slides I've just seen the possibility even on the roadmap for skills. But it underpins this analysis, what we've received here, actually underpins what we've, the presentations that we've seen from different quarters over the last while. But let me therefore hand over to the members. Just before that, Graham, critical aspects of the roadmap talks to teachers on time, in class, discipline, etc. And then an example that you brought in was matric results. One of the success and one of our performance measures would be the fact that we're able to get our papers out in the majority of cases. They're able to write exams, etc. Isn't that what the education department is supposed to do? What is so amazing? What is so successful if matric results are out on time? One. Two, teachers being in class, being disciplined. Aren't they supposed to be in class and be disciplined? So if one are able to most probably just before members also raise issues, just that, and therefore the most probably is the analysis there, and in the last 3 months, I wonder how many teachers were not in class on time and disciplined, and what therefore has happened to those particular teachers. Because the state of the nation address happened a few months, 4 months ago or so. What therefore is the monitoring, and are we capturing the imagination of people to make sure that that is the focus? But whilst we are doing that, isn't there just supposed to be measuring realities from that point already to ensure that that happens? Just a comment on what I've said, and then I want to open up for members to engage.
My only comment to your person is yes. I think you're right that when we think that being in class on time is an achievement and teaching, and then some of the things like just using textbooks, I mean, even if teachers suffer from content knowledge, the fact is that you can open your textbook. It's got the whole curriculum in it, but you need to know that by June you should have covered these chapters. And I think a lot of that depends on the principals and how well organized they are, the kind of leadership that's given. So, I mean, I think it's a case of both understanding the backlogs that maybe there's a level at which teachers don't know how to use textbooks. We find that most children don't have textbooks in their hands. We find that in the foundations of reading, I mean, even with all the criticism of OBE, OBE never said that you can't get children to read every day and to write. And I think the HESA report said that university students can't write. And one of the reasons is because right back in grade 3, now the Foundations for Learning campaign of the department says that you will write at least a certain number of pieces per week. It might be every day, I think, that you will write, and certainly you will read every day. And those are basics that we haven't put in place. So I think you're absolutely right, Chief.
Yeah, I'll allow for members, but one of the issues for me is the fact of principals and being managers, and rectors being managers and all of that. But we all can speak to that, Ms. Kabai.
And you could take your policy to run
to a committee. Understandable. I think you're not the only person that are having that same problem. Ms. Kabai.
Thanks, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation by Mr. Block. I think one of the critical issues that he's raising, or the roadmap is raising as well in his discussion, it's reflecting on where we come from, which I think is a critical issue, so that we are able to gauge where we are and where we are going. The issues of the past in terms of even tertiary education, because what I want to come to Chairperson is the issue of access. Not only on access, getting a number of students, but where the institutions are located to ensuring that black students are able to access them. To ensuring that where the institutions are located, even the point that, because we're talking about number of institutions, because access could mean that we open the doors for all the students to go into, you know, having access to university. But again, the fact that you would find that at some point the capacity within these institutions become a problem. And then you find that even the level of quality of teaching, being a student, you don't get the same level of what used to happen in the past. You're looking at the issue of the institution, I mean, I'm bringing it to the major itself. At the time, I was still a student leader when the major happened. And you find that as we synchronize and the importance of having a major, because you look at where I was, so went to campus in Vista, and just an hour's drive, that university was one of the best. And the facilities and everything that that university has, you could not have them at Vista. And that was one of the things that, and I'm glad to see what is happening now, as I mentioned last time. So you're even seeing the boarding school being, you know, the residence being built in Soweto campus, which is now University of Johannesburg, which sort of somehow gives you the indication of the importance of that measure. But what here I think we still need to address is to saying in that particular area, or how many of those institutions have been able to bring within down to the level where the people are. The example that you're making from Khayelitsha to the next available university, how long does it take for a black, because that's why you find, you don't find these institutions in black communities. You find them in the white, previously white dominated areas, which makes it a bit easier access for white students than a black child. And hence I'm raising this issue, looking at the stats that is reflecting to say we're still not making progress if we're still stuck with 65% of 2003. But again, I'm glad the report also raises the issue of the behavior of academics relating to academic freedom. Within South Africa, we have a bit of a challenge because we have academics sitting at the back, raising issues as outsiders, not participants and players of the system. Which I think, I remember even last year or early this year, when Comrade Balekan met, in her capacity as Deputy President then, was delivering a lecture in University of KwaZulu-Natal and raised these critical issues. She said, we can't continue to have academics who are not part of the system, who are not part of finding a solution, but sits at the back and saying, these are the problems that are there, and therefore they must be found, solution must be found. So I think I'm just raising this issue as well, Chair, that it's one of the things, and as I think that as portfolio committee, we'd have to find a way of engaging academics and making sure that they're part of us in finding solutions that we need to do. But lastly, Chair, the comment on skills side, skills development and skills sector. Chair, one of the things I would like to disagree is to say that when we look at things that are not working and we take, I think, Dr. Block, you correct me, Mr. Block, you correct me if I'm wrong. But the implication that, or the indication that you gave here was to say that the fact that there are challenges in teachers, we should be taking a decision to say, why don't we close them down? And I would like to have a different view on that one, because for me to say that let's look at the problem, what is the root of the problem that the skills sector is not succeeding, do a review and make and put in the, you know, put measures to make them work. Because I think they have a critical role to play. We have a number of dropouts of students, which FETs only can't resolve. We still need those learnership. We still need those internship. We still need those You know, the fact that the role that they play. I don't think that we have reached a point where we can say. We can just close them down and therefore they are not working. But I think that we can look at the way to say, let's evaluate what has happened and therefore how do we resolve and fix them. I'm of that view that we still can have those fixed. Why are you saying that we tend to look at little things and we want to tweak and think we can win? But an overview of how the challenges, what the challenges have been, could assist us in resolving the issues of the future. Thanks, Chair. Those are the issues I wanted to bring.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would also want to add my echoes to thank our education specialist, Mr. Block, because he came with he's enhancing the plan that we have in Parliament. And perhaps one would like to speak to one or two issues. I'll start with the famous quotation from our president. Everybody talks about it, teachers in class. But then I'm shaking with serious concern that are we viewing it from the same point of view? Because we the former speaker said, we cannot afford, you know, to continue to be divided in this particular issue, where you quote that and say, okay, he said teachers must be in class. What is he going to do about it? Because it's not about him. I want to believe that's why we're here, all of us. Such that, perhaps if we can become players, it's very easy for people, or for everybody, myself included. So, like, when we speak, we are telling other people, but I like to tell everybody, including myself. It's interesting to say, whenever I go to church and you preach and say, you must, I don't understand you because you must say we must. The same thing here. That, yes, we are here to make sure that learners must be in class. All of us. Because we can do it together in no other way. There is no one who came here to be a spectator, to watch and see whether the president manages to do it or not. So that if we can agree at this level and identify our specific role, because we cannot continue to be like talking about it and not ensuring that it really happens there. And you cannot, there is no way anyone can ensure that teachers are in class seated far away from that particular class. It has never happened. You need to make a turn there, most unfortunately unannounced, to know that teachers are in class. I know that the Department of Education, they visit schools. It's in their program. When you go there, the program is there. But I'm checking if here in Parliament we can boast to say we have a plan or we're about to have a plan to know that we'll be going to these institutions to see what's happening there, unannounced. I know that there are those of us who are saying if we go there unannounced, we are fault finders. There's no way you know that teachers are in class or not if you tell them that you'll be there. I mean, if you tell me that you are coming to my place, I'll cook things that we never cook normally. And you'll think that we eat well and the house will be so clean. But if you just come, you'll see the real me. What I'm trying to say is that we need to be involved. And we need to do it maybe drastically. By going there unannounced, really, as a committee, we definitely need to. Because it will end up on paper. The president has every had a very good intention and we believed in it. Everybody who spoke across the political parties were very much interested on that particular thing. So what is it that we're going to do? We assess for, the president is assessed on 100 days. My understanding is that we are assessed on 100 days. What have we done? How many institutions have we visited that far? To make sure that these educators are in class.
Chairperson, with respect, may I just give one incident that would also impact on this? Within the last month, MEC Nuno from KwaZulu-Natal with the head of department, Cassius Labisi, went unannounced to visit a number of schools in KwaZulu-Natal. Yes. And they got to one particular school and they found SATU standing at the gate and refused to allow them admission. And the SATU teacher said, you do not come in here without announcing. And they actually said, the MEC said, but I'm MEC, I'm entitled. And they said, no. And the MEC actually was forced to retreat. So that's how, I mean, it's obviously an extreme example.
Yeah, thank you. That's excellent. Because I talk about it because I know that they say that the first time if you visit. But because I also know that SATU at the national level have never issued a statement to say that nobody must visit. Today, if it's done, I'm a little bit unaware of it. So that if we go there, we'll change these bullies, because they are bullies, definitely. And if nobody does anything about it, the bullying will continue. So my plea is that we do something about it. That I'm looking at the dysfunctional school clause that we have here on page 8, that teachers in townships spend 3.5 hours, while those ones in suburban schools, it's 6 hours. And I'm amazed, because I know that the same educational law is for all. Like, I know that it's 25 hours per week at the foundation phase, and it goes on to 25 hours. We have 26 hours. We have 29 hours. The different levels. We'll be giving those hours per week. Now, if I know that you also said that the loss of teaching is caused by the form filling, but the forms must be filled once. That's my understanding. So that if it's like given this, it's like it's continuous, and something has to be done about it also. So that we need to go out there. The long and the short of it is that we need to participate, all of us. Like, it's true that together definitely we can do more. We cannot afford to watch, especially from this level. You can't watch and be paid for watching. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Member Fukuza.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sorry to have been late. And thank you to the presenter, Dr. Block.
Yes,
Mr. Block. Okay, thank you, Mr. Block. Unfortunately, I was not at the beginning of your presentation, so maybe I may have missed one or two things. You spoke about the lack of plan, or a plan, or the lack of vision, which is something I'm also calling for. But to the extent that I haven't seen your own vision, and to the extent that then I don't know how, what role you could play in facilitating that such a plan or such a vision is pursued. I'm just tempted to ask if there is a way that you yourself, depending on your own mandate, you could facilitate such a plan or such plans to happen, you know, with your insights in terms of education. That's number one. Number two, yeah, when I joined the higher education many moons ago, there was I don't know how to call these slogans, if you like. It was the culture of learning and teaching. And it came and it went. And it was never unpacked what it meant. What is the culture of learning and teaching to the extent that it would have then done what it was meant to do? And so from there we have evolved through all sorts of slogans to a slogan today that says teachers in class on time teaching. I don't know where that comes from. I'm familiar with it from the manufacturing principles or production principles that say just in time. And that means that anything that is needed, it's called the JIT principles, anything that is needed is there on time. But it's a huge thing to say, because it assumes that all sorts of things have happened before teachers are in class teaching on time. It means that all things have happened before that happens. It means that the environment has been readied such that that happens. It's actually the last thing to happen before everything else can happen. And that leads to the third question, which has an impact on that, to say, in your fix number one plan, let me call it for a lack of a better word, you're talking about stakeholders. Again, avoiding sloganeering. What are stakeholders? Can we have a stakeholder wheel where we enlist the type of stakeholders we think are implicated in the landscape, scenario, and platform of education, and identify roles and accountabilities by stakeholders? It's okay to say stakeholders must come. So I'm saying that I'm very much into the unpacking of these slogans, because they come and go, and they are sexy, and they make for good conversations, they make for good politicking, but what are they in essence? So what are the stakeholders in education, and who are they, and what are the roles and respective accountabilities of this? Like, for example, the example you're making to saying the MEC pitches up and SATU says, no, those are stakeholders with respective accountabilities. But what are those to the extent that outcomes that we would like to see come out, they do? You know, because for me, it looks like there are some roles that would supersede others in the same stakeholder wheel. So I am interested in a stakeholder wheel concept. The last one, we also speak, and I got in here, you were speaking about the HIV/AIDS. And to the extent that we have statistics, I don't have precise ones from now, to saying that actually we like talking about learners as being affected by HIV/AIDS as household executives, whatever you call them, they because they are orphans. And a whole lot of things. But I am interested in a study of the incidence of HIV/AIDS at school and tertiary. Because, again, in me being obsessive about this tracking thing about where students go, I am tempted, and I have but one anecdotal input to saying we are losing some of them through HIV/AIDS, because if you look at statistics, it actually catches them at a time when they are at tertiary. Is there a way we could track that kind of HIV/AIDS incidence in schooling, especially at tertiary institutions? Because that's exactly the age where this is very rife. And I just rest it there for now. Thank you.
Graham, you raised a wide variety of quite fundamental points. So, and I wondered whether we could just focus on one, which has to do with the issue of quality. And I'm talking about schools, not universities, although, of course, they're linked. And let me ask the question just from experience. I've been involved with the University of Cape Town's medical school for the last 5 years, and I know how they admit their students. What they do is they go and find them. That is, every year, 65 new first-year students come in to UCT because UCT recruits those students. And it makes no compromise on quality. And I don't have to hear the argument here. Nobody wants to go to a medical physician when there's knowledge that training is inferior. You can't build proper bridges and infrastructure with inferior engineers and so on the hard side of service. So the university makes no compromise on it at all. The class right now, the first year intake class, is 65% black, okay? Just in terms of bean counting the students, in terms of their appearance, it meets more than meets any affirmative action requirement. So what they do is they go out and they find the talented students, and they find the best students. Some of the students are foreign. Now, there is the argument, just to extrapolate that example, that says that to fix the public schooling system in this country is going to take a very long time. It's going to take 30 years. It's going to take 2 years per grade to fix it, to fix the components you're raising, train the teachers, get the school environment right by proper management, and find a way of mediating with the environment, because you won't fix the crime problem just like that. It's going to take 30 years. What do we do in the meantime? We go to universities and we ask universities, what kind of quality students do you need? And then we go and find the students. Where would you find them? You'd find them at former Model C schools. And you'd find them in a growing private school system. That's where you'll find them. And the challenge is, for people who have that argument, that you have to make sure that you find talent where it is located, including and especially in communities that have been underserved. So you find your talented black students. So affirmative action means sniff out the talent in townships and in rural areas. And that's the approach. So it's to say that the issue is about quality, and I really would just like you to focus on just remark, make a few remarks around quality questions. And just the last point is that I've been involved in funding charter schools in America through the Ford Foundation. And in the U.S., as you know, they have a very vibrant university sector, and the University of California or Harvard University or Yale University, they find their talented students. It's not a problem. Because the pool is so large in the U.S. Because the public system, schooling system, has been failing for the last 30 years. Just go to a public school in Harlem, you can see. And so the feeder school system into the university sector are the charter schools, and the charter schools are the equivalent of our former Model C schools. They're quality schools. And that's what universities invest in. So you have this strange mix of a failing public school system that every politician that comes to office wants to fix, and they never succeed, from George Bush backwards, today to Obama, he has to focus on it. They never succeed in it. What universities do is they just sniff at the talent using what days. And it's unfortunately true that we face a similar kind of reality, which is not to say that we mustn't try to fix the public schools. I'm not saying that at all. Sorry, I've been a bit long-winded, but if you could just comment on the question of quality.
Mr. Nelson?
Sure, listen, yes. My view is also that we can have all the policies, we can have all the plans, the programs in place. But are we really setting out to achieve what we want? On the issue of the culture of learning, getting kids back, teachers into class on time teaching, if we look at what is happening, Dr. James has just raised an issue of Model C schools. We find even in those Model C schools that the standard is dropping. Ill discipline, and I've had the opportunity in the last 2 weeks to speak to a Model C school within our area that has gone, in my own opinion, totally down the drain. And the take I have on that is that teachers don't really know how to deal with the kids. Given all these social problems that these children are experiencing, the background that they are coming out of, and something that has come out very strongly from the school itself was that we have kids in the school who are almost more educated than their parents, and the parents don't know how to deal with the kids. And teachers, but I also had the sense that there's not the same amount of enthusiasm that there was from the side of the teachers into the school, because the school has now become a black school, and it doesn't have, it isn't this white school that it used to be. So my issue is on, our teachers aren't able to deal with the problems that the schools are facing today. And if we want to, it's all very well for universities to go and scout and to reach their targets, but what is happening to everybody else that is falling through the cracks? It's fine to reach 65%, but we've got many, many young people out of there that are walking the streets, that are not doing anything, that are unemployed because of the schooling system or the problems that we are facing within our schooling system. Another challenge that I think that we have is the learnership. I speak from the view that I know of, at least also in the area that we are, kids that have taken up learnerships, that have gone out of FETs and taken up learnerships with ESCOM, for instance, and ESCOM not having a plan for those learners. They sit there, they do absolutely nothing. Kids cut grass. They do whatever they can find to do, because these companies that take these kids into the learnership don't have a program or a plan. And I think that we need to be doing something about that, because those kids inevitably fall out and drop out because they feel they're not doing anything and either go back or they just fall along the wayside. So I think that our challenges are huge, but we need to find ways to address these problems. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, and thanks for the presentation as well. Just about the four issues. The first will relate to quality of education. there's a challenge by universities that the kind of learners or students who are there are not ready or sufficiently prepared to can, you know, deal with the stuff they're receiving at higher institutions. But then at the same time, in terms of public education or public schools, we are able to check the quality of the material they're receiving when they pass their matric and so on and so on. That was being done by UMALOS. And it's like the quality there, it's almost agreed in the country that it's good. Now, what does it mean? Do they pass without, or is that quality being questionable? Because to me, if somebody assesses again, after some people have been assessed, someone are being unfairly treated. If they go through one measure, you say they're fine. Shortly after that, 3 months or so, when they've now entered university, you assess them differently and you say they've not qualified. It means the instruments we are using, or not every stakeholder agrees that the quality that we're talking about is there. Or another measure to unfairly treat them is being introduced so that you undermine what government publicly says this is the quality that we think should happen. And I just think probably we need more to deal with that kind of an issue. The second, you referred to the engagement process that every stakeholder should be involved and so on and so on in that process, or to find solutions to all this should be stakeholder-driven, which I agree without going into the nitty-gritties of stakeholder partners and all that sort of things. But all of us should be involved. But I just also think that at the core of that process, the critical stakeholders or those who should drive the process should somewhat project the timelines, because we can't just open the process forever. At some point we must say we are all agreed as the country, having consulted everybody almost through their stakeholders or whatever their organizations, to say now we think we're ready to just implement. I know we're not stopping and say until we find solutions we can't implement, but I'm saying the quicker we arrive at that consensus, broad consensus, the better. And I haven't had you touching on anything like that. The other is that we can't look at this in a peaceful, piecemeal kind of fashion. At one point you talk that participation should be at this level. At another, you want to talk about everybody being involved already from teacher's level, and so on and so on. Because what I think we should be holistically be able to say the problems that we have got are this huge or gigantic, and this will cost the country this much, so that we look at almost everything at once and say perhaps we may not be ready as the country to undertake this particular problem at once. It was like, I agree with prioritization anyway, but I'm saying if we were to have every child in school learning and all classes ready in terms of teacher pupil ratio, have all the infrastructure, everything, what does it mean to the country? Can the budget that we have be able to take charge of that, feeding them, everything that we think we must do? I'm not sure there's been anything like that, checking the overall, you know, cost implications to this whole thing. What are we looking at? I'm not saying we must fear to engage it because it will be costly, because to me, it's even costly when you don't attend to it. More costly, you know. Now, if we were to attend to it, what are we talking about? And so on, vis-a-vis our own budget in the country. But the other, in terms of sit-ups, is just a question which is direct, whether DBSA is somewhat involved in the review process that is being facilitated now. Because in some ways, I think you should be able to play a role and your input or your viewpoint be accommodated at that level. Throughout, and I was also trying to do a quick check on some documents, I don't find where you're dealing with the issues of governance in schools. The role of the school governing bodies, whether they are being effective or not, even as we want to play that oversight role. Our understanding, or my understanding by now, is that you've got some governance at that level that is supposed to be happening close by. Yes, you need your MEC to come monitor, you need whoever, but you have got people other than just teachers and the management there who are supposed to play a role. Yes, there are weaknesses, some of which are that these parents are not necessarily clued up or quite aware of what should happen in there, but then some other solutions to that kind of a thing should actually happen. I know, Chair, that we're looking at most of this and in terms of the input when we are higher education, and some of the issues or most of the issues emerging perhaps needed basic education to actually engage more. But for us to understand it as a basis, also it's actually good. I'm just saying when we seem to be overlapping, it's not that also not clear what is supposed to be our role as higher education PC, but also that the type of input that came or presentation led us to also handle some of these issues. Thanks.
But, now let me, I'm just going in the, I'm actually completing this row.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much, Mr. Block. We've been going through your documents. One issue that I realize is that immediately you disappear, I'll never track you. I'll never be able to talk to you. And that is serious. I need to talk to you anytime to engage with you, not only the secretary, but us all. The second issue that I want to raise, we had a strategic plan on the 5th and the 6th in La Via Hotel in Gordon's Bay. As a committee, we came to a conclusion that the NSFAS is not accessible to the students in the remote areas. You are saying in your document that the NSFAS has expanded dramatically. Can you explain that? Thanks, Chair.
George Benama.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Block, for your presentation. I think we all agree that our education is in deep crisis. However, it's not going to assist anybody if we sit in palavras like this one and keep on talking, lamenting, and rationalizing about it. I think we need to stand up and roll up our sleeves and begin to fix our education. You made a very important point when you said that children need to be given good foundation, and I think you referred to the great R, which is very important, and we've been talking about this for quite some time. And we cannot fix the foundation unless we have people trained specifically to fix that foundation, the great R. And once we have fixed the great R, then we are sure that when we send these children to grade one, we're sending children who are well prepared for schooling. And these children must find in primary teachers that are well-trained, well-disciplined, to teach them. Then we know that when they go to the high school, they are well prepared to acquit themselves very well in the high school. Then the high school will produce matrics who are ready for universities, and universities will never have a problem. However, you also said schools can teach what we don't see at our homes, which is very important. And to me, what rang in my mind was, if our homes do not ensure that children are disciplined, then we have a very, very serious problem, because ill-disciplined children from various homes will take that behavior to schools, and they will create problems for teachers, and they cannot be teaching and learning where there is absence of discipline. And we need to actually talk to parents about this. They can play a very, very important role, because parents must parent children well so that teachers can be able to parent children well at school. You have made mention of the apartheid and its effects on us. Yes, we know that apartheid was a bad system of government, and it has caused a drawback. However, we cannot keep on blaming apartheid forever. If we do this, this is going to now serve to hold us back, because we are going to blame apartheid even for our own failures. We should put apartheid at our back, it died 15 years ago, and move forward and do things the way we want to have them done. One other thing is the failure of the district office to provide pedagogic support to schools. This is the most important thing. And, you know, if you look at how many schools at the end of every year fail to produce a single matric pass, and the district officials get surprised as any of us, because why they've not been visiting the schools? They could have identified the problems earlier had they been visiting the schools. Because in schools where management is a problem, it's very, very bad. You find that the SMT is not able to run the school as they should. Then the district office is there to ensure that, to find out what is happening in this school and put things right earlier in the year. But there are problems. One of them is that one that you mentioned, that when the district officials want to visit the school, they are barred by such members. This is happening in many schools. Very, very many schools can't be visited because you find the principal there himself is a member of SATU. You find that the most teacher component belongs to SATU. And these schools cannot be visited, and if the schools cannot be visited by officials, then work cannot be done properly. We have schools in the Northwest which were actually on news this very week, that too many schools in Northwest have not yet received their textbooks. Now, by July last year again, over 500 schools in the Northwest had not yet received their textbooks. Now, sometimes we expect a lot from teachers when we don't give support, even by the department itself. I mean, supplying books to the school, ensuring that schools have equipment, is the work of the department. They must ensure that the schools receive books for the next year in September this year, or at least October this year, so that when the schools reopen in the new year, teaching and learning takes place smoothly. But this is not the case. And you can't then blame teachers for that. Education can only be able to be driven properly if all stakeholders play their role. The other thing is security. Our schools are the most unsafest places in this country to be at. Children die at schools, teachers die at schools, people are robbed at schools, and it's because we have been talking about lack of security in schools, but we don't do anything about it to ensure that the schools are secured, that children, once they step into the school, they can feel safe, teachers can feel safe and begin to teach relaxed, and we need to ensure that schools are safe. Teachers to be at school on time is another thing, but I'm not sure how can we ensure that teachers are at school on time teaching unless, again, district officials work hand in glove with the SMTs on a daily basis. I think I'll rest my case there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My apologies for being late. Mr. Block has a nice presentation, but I've been puzzled by a few issues here in your presentation. Your document says taking education forward. The roadmap taking education forward. My layman understanding is that this document must provide solutions. If I'm correct, I'm just looking at one of your sentence where he said we need to have a plan. We need a vision. My understanding that you are an education specialist, you must provide us with a plan and a vision so that you can be able to combine our vision and your ideas, taking issues forward. I haven't seen that being presented in the document. Nevertheless, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt that maybe because I arrived late, I didn't get everything. Oh, yeah, videos. Okay, that's why I'm saying I didn't get the document. Well, the issue that I was just checking here is that what's the challenge in terms of us finding a larger percentage of white students getting access to universities and a little percentage of black people getting access to universities? My understanding is that maybe it's because we have been found well transformative way, or those institutions, they are not yet 100% transformed. I remember I had another experience while I was at Pretoria Technical. I was wanted to write these examinations. I got an exemption, my matric. I passed my math and science, very nice. But when I arrived there, a white student that I've mistakenly pinched into his results, he has got lousy marks in his math and science.
But the treatment that you receive, it was different. I questioned the lecturer. They asked me whether I'm here to study or here to question us. And I decided to keep quiet. That's when I decided also to ensure that the student movement attend to these issues. So what I'm saying is that the most challenges that we're also having is that it is not because black students, some of them, they don't have good qualifications and stuff, but the accessibility or the way of accepting them to these institutions, that's the main challenge. The issue of dropout, it's a matter of resource availability and support. Because I can tell you, you can go and ask any student. You'll find a student that has good results. He couldn't be able to get a bursary or any financial assistance. He dropped out because he doesn't have financial support to go back to that university. And you also ask yourself whether has the lecturers in those classes, as they know the background, the educational background of that student, have they managed to track and check whether can they assist or whatsoever? That's one of the other issues that I think we must be able to look at, because it's a very crucial aspect. And it's very much important that we also look whether the support that we're giving the institutions, where you find, because you see, the reason that some of these teachers, you'll find them standing at the gate closing, says there's no accessibility of other officials to come and assess the situation inside. It's because we are acting like fire extinguishers. If we can stop acting like fire extinguishers, I think we might be able to come up with a solution or solutions in terms of this matter. We must be able to go to this. It must be a norm for us to say we'll go to these institutions, do an oversight, check what is happening, can we assist or not? Because in most cases we say we're going to do surprise visits, because we've heard already that there's problems there. And immediately we go there, we're going to, you know, these students are not being taught and all that stuff, because we've already found that there's a problem. We're just going there to fight with this. We're not just going there to assess the situation and assist. Maybe we should find a solution to say, my honorable member next to me here has just mentioned to say, you know, a regular interaction with these institutions will assist. So that when we say there's no school material, there are no textbooks at school, you can't just come January and say there are no textbooks at school. Because that means there was no plan ahead to assess that. That means this year, when we are planning for the following year, we must be able to come up with a solution to say, next year we're expecting to take these intakes of students. We must prepare how many textbooks. So that around the time of delivery of textbooks of October, November, December, all the officials, they go there and assess and check and assist to ensure that all the materials are available. So that you don't come January and say, yeah, but you see, teachers are not teaching. Because they will come with excuses that there's no material as well. So we must be able that the support that we provide is an ahead plan that should be a advanced planning to assist our education to be effective. Lastly, Chair, the issue of the NS funds. I don't know how can we take, you know, this is very passionate of my quiz day. He's very passionate about the issue of NS1. But my mine is to also looking into, you see, we haven't looked to also broaden this aspect. Because we must be able to provide, when we say you're providing this financial aid, there must be a holistic approach. There must be a way that will ensure that when the student receives, you know, when you bought a new car, you feel that there's a value to that car. You wake up early in the morning, wash it, even if it's not necessary. So we must be able to, when we provide this, because the NSFAS, when it's being provided to these students, you find them, you know, their mentality here is that they are going to pay it back, but with painful results at the end, with interest and the stuff. If you can be able to find a better way of When we provide it, it must also give value that the person must also feel that, you see, this belongs to me as a South African. But also, it must also pay a good result. You know, I mustn't find myself being on debt after finishing school. Already, I mean, credit bureaus, anyway, credit bureaus is no longer there now. But, you know, those debts that also incurred with these financial aids that are given to students, you must be able to find a way of at least come up with also ways and also counseling along those processes. Because I think it's very much, it's one of the support that you must be also be given. Thanks.
Thank you. What will do is I've allowed members to raise the issues. I'm not expecting, Graham, that you need to respond on every single issue. I think a lot of those things were comments. Our secretary is also supposed to note some of those comments because it does form part of our strategic interventions in the future. It is a committee that's here for the last 3 months, and therefore we'll be looking at these critical things and suggestions over a longer period. However, Member George, the issue around, and it came out of this presentation, I think Graham contextualized it in the context of when Verhoerd raised those issues. But is it so that apartheid really died 15 years ago? Or its implications has died 15 years ago. And what is the cut of time when apartheid, if we need to stop blaming that is a critical. Graham, I recall that in 1993, a black child in South Africa still received a bursary. Now that black child would possibly be other student now, etc. A black child through a subsidy received a subsidy of roughly 780 rand. That's black African. A colored child, 2,000 rand, and a white child, 4,800 rand. Now that's as recent as 93 when apartheid died in 94. And I use the word, it will just die the way you've introduced it. Gotta love it. Yeah. Or as somebody else said, it was very too fluck. Shallow. It eats up.
The other thing is, who does it now that we are holding the reins? Are we now pressing the advantage on our own children?
No. I think that the point is the implications of the actions of a couple of years. I normally say not a doctor like James, but a medical doctor. If a doctor makes a mistake, you bury that mistake quickly. If education departments makes mistake, you live for that for many, many years. If teachers make mistake, you live for that for many, many years. So it is a deeper rooted thing, and to turn it around, it's therefore not, it's not that necessary kind of. I thought of raising and contextualizing, but still appreciating the point that Honourable Member George has raised. Over to you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and I totally agree with you. Thank you to members for a very complex debate, and I say that in a positive way. But let me just say that, so if I don't answer specific questions, please just come back and note that.
Am I allowed to help myself to coffee?
I wonder why they do this. I think there is one of our members that are under pressure because our work decided also to deploy into basic education. So we've got that challenge. Can't we just quickly get members, if they want to grab a coffee, get the coffee and come back, otherwise the school principal will...
I don't know if I've intimidated members.
I might be.
And you don't have to agree with me. I'm sure people, as I hear this committee, they would have their own political, their own viewpoint. But what I do, and the point I want to underline is that 15 years on, if there's one thing we haven't done, it's to have the national debate about education. That if we'd had that debate, we would all be able to say what the vision is. And I think that's part of the question that people have been asking me and putting me on the spot for. I mean, if I had to say what the vision is, in one sense, it would be a learning nation striving for academic excellence and intellectual excellence. And I think we get completely contradictory things. We have, and I'll give you a very concrete example. We have the Youth League leader going to Cape Peninsula University of Technology down the road in the election campaign. And he said to the students there, why do you want to go to Oxford or Cambridge? Why do you want to bother? Now, all the issues we've raised here about Africanizing curriculums and so on, but the point is that if you're a CPUT student, go to Oxford and Cambridge, aspire to go there, and then come back. And don't think that what you learnt in Oxford is the be-all and end-all of the world, but come back. Or our same Youth League leader goes to the youth, and he says, look at our president. Our president's got standard 2, so you don't need to achieve in school, because you can be standard 2 and still be president of the country and understand political economy. Yet our president, when he goes to Bukalani High School in Soweto, his message is completely different. He says, look at me, I've only got a standard 2. I wish I had the chances you young children have to have a teacher standing in front of you. I never had that opportunity. And he says, you guys work hard and be the best you can. So that's why I say when you have that message outside in society being given to the youth, how are you going to get it right in the schools? And we need to get on message. I think the debate, so that's what I think the debate is. But I mean, I think the vision, I could throw the vision question back to you and say, I'm not the political leadership. I didn't pass the Paul Aquani resolution saying teachers shall be in class on time. You know, you are the leading party. Yours is the Minister of Basic Education. What is her vision? And maybe that's part of the question that Jonathan Jansen was asking so very rudely recently, was to say he doesn't hear her coming with the message in the same way, let's say, that the Minister for Higher Education has been intervening. And it may be that the message is there and developing, but we're not hearing it in a public dialogue, and I think that's why it's getting worried. Look, when, and as I say, I will summarize, but when one looks at these statistics, it's sometimes quite bleak. You think, good heavens, how are we ever going to escape our past? But we need to remind ourselves that if you were 70 years ago in England, in the UK, just 70 years ago, and you were a Welsh child, you would be taken out of school at the age of 14 and sent down the tin mines. And people were dying left, right, and centre in England from cholera and waterborne diseases before the Second World War. And it took the trade unions and the Second World War to get planning and to get fighting like hell to get a system where the working class could get access to education. And even today in England, we see that the working class struggles to get into the better universities, that classes. So it's not something that will happen immediately. But if we don't give leadership and get going now, we can be sure that that past will stay with us. And I think that's, you know, that's the conflict I'm picking up all the time from what people are saying. Because on the one hand, Mr. Bonomo, I mean, for me, I'll give you one example of why apartheid still affects us. We don't have math teachers. I could not find, there are 26,000 schools altogether. Where am I going to find even 26,000 math teachers? Because apartheid did not teach people. So let's assume we find all the math teachers and we put them, like you suggested, in grade one. Will we then have enough teachers next year for when they come into grade two and then grade three? So it's going to take at least 15 years or 12 years through the system. And then all those kids with their brilliant math results, they're not going to want to be math teachers. They're going to want to be accountants and business people and parliamentarians and wonderful things like that. And so... So yes, history, you know, and the burden of history is very much with us. On the one hand. On the other hand, I hear people saying, well, the universities haven't been 100% transformed, so what do we expect from our students? Or how can you tell teachers to be in class on time when the textbooks aren't always there or our schools have got backlogs? And that's the space we've got to struggle with. That is our heritage, but how much are we going to make excuses? And I mean, really, do you really need... Yeah, you do. I mean, I've seen toilets for teachers that are a little hooky falling over and a bucket that hasn't been emptied for 6 months. And you think, ish, well, no wonder the teachers don't want to go to school, you know. But still, as I said, I didn't pass the resolution to say teachers shall be in class on time. Surely that's the least they can do anyway if we're going to pull ourselves up. And look, we can debate. I mean, there are lots of debates. And one of the main points I'm making is we need to debate. But let's say on this test. I don't understand why you keep on making excuses. I think working class children must get into university and we must find the money and we must give them enough money to get through university, and I don't think the staff does that. But good heavens, 15% of black kids get into university. When they pass, half of them pass, they're going to be the bourgeoisie of tomorrow. They're going to earn more than any of us will ever see. And now you say they mustn't pay back their loans so that other poor children can get in. Now you let them off the hook because once upon a time they were working class. I think there's a contradiction there, and that's all I'm saying. And we're never tough enough to handle it. We come saying, this does not give free bursaries. Can we afford that? We certainly must give big enough bursaries so they get through university and they get access. And similarly, the question of Model C schools. Model C schools, it's unfair that most kids who are in Model C schools have got better facilities. That's the bottom line. And most of them are white. Not all of them are white. But now we're going to attack Model C schools and say they're not allowed to charge fees and destroy one place where some black kids are getting access. Destroy that. How is that going to help the other 90% who are sitting in township schools? How does that help them? So these schools belong to all of us, both the Model C schools and the 90% of township schools. So how do we find a solution that includes all of them rather than just... And so I'm saying it's very complex. And I happen to think... I mean, I've seen examples of... You know, you get the Model C schools where a few people in Ermelo are trying very hard to keep out anybody from the township, and they use Afrikaans as an excuse. They're all one or two examples. On the other hand, I've seen General Smith's Hoort School in Vereniging. And their teacher, Mr. Bachi, he talks about his wonderful children and how they do in the Olympiads and how they do in the sports and how wonderful they do in their music and so on. And he's talking about 97% of them are black children. And it's a former Model C school. It's still got white staff, the old Afrikaner white staff. but it's completely transformed its demographics. And that white staff is so proud and love their children so much, you would think they come from the same communities. And maybe they have made that transition. So, you know, so things are very contradictory. And obviously we must put challenges to the Model C schools and say you can't keep on having white staff. But then I would throw back the thing and say, how come 85% of our teacher trainees are white girls? Where are the black young black kids going to come from that are going to start those Model C schools? Do you want those Model C schools to go to the township schools, find the best schools, take them out into the suburbs and leave the township schools with the worst teachers? That's why I say it's complex and it needs debate. So just let me in summary say, for me the three main points that have come out, the question of stakeholders and the question who are the stakeholders. I think in the first place it's government, and government needs to lead. I mean, I believe that, especially if we're talking about the public school system as the main area. But it's government and teachers. And that's why I think we need that combined thing of an approach to teachers that is, look, it doesn't help to shout at teachers. It doesn't help to just say you will be in class. You need to listen. But at the same time as listening, you also need to, you know, you need to find that balance of support and discipline. And I agree with a lot of the things people have said. Teachers are struggling. The students are different. The students are undisciplined. If you listen to teachers, it's tough out there. And by the way, beating children is not going to help. Because even if you can beat children, even if we had corporal punishment, surely you're not going to use corporal punishment every single time. And so do you have other weapons in your armory? What do you do when you're not beating them? How do you get them disciplined on a normal day? Do you behave like the school principal I did and just intimidate everyone? You know, how do you get everyone into their class? And so, I think corporal punishment should be banned because I think our problem in this country is too much violence and child abuse. And if we allow corporal punishment, we're not going to be able to tell that boundary. But still, there is a question of discipline. So yes, so in the first place it's government and teachers. I think in the second place it's citizens need to rally around. And I think that message of it needs to be a societal concern is absolutely right. It includes Department of Health because of HIV/AIDS and all those other issues. It includes the police because of gangs. So we need to see how we integrate. But it also includes citizens. And I mean, for me, the best example is the Ploughback movement. You know, whether it's Historic Schools Restoration Project, which is trying to do the old church schools. People are going back to those old schools they came from. Or graduates from schools in Mellenberg or Bridgetown, like my wife does. The people, all of you have come from schools that are probably not in great shape. And if you get together with other graduates from the schools and go back to those schools, those children in those schools in the rural areas will now have access. How do I become a parliamentarian? I don't know. Unless I know that somebody has become a parliamentarian and they can go and actually. So I think building those networks by going back to your schools are things that citizens can do. Making sure that if I employ someone, I make sure that their children are in school. And it's very simple things. But we need to call on the nation to find, which is how we defeated apartheid. Everybody did their little thing. And, you know, and it will be different in a church, from an NGO, from the DBSA, from Parliament. And what I've said there is this is why I really have emphasized the question of conversations, and that is one of the things that DBSA is trying to do, these series of conversations. I think that's what your committee is obviously doing, is feeding into the public debate, because ultimately those stakeholders are not going to be pushed into place. So we need to have the conversations with teachers and hear what their problems are and listen and take them very seriously. But I think engaging with stakeholders doesn't mean that you fail to lead. And I think that was a really important question somebody asked about, you know, when is it over? When do we stop debating? And that's why I say we've got a 10-point plan. But I say it's not the end be all and the end all. You know, I can draw up the 10-point plan. I can draw it up. I think any process of debate will probably come similar to the 10-point plan. And it might have differences here and there. But I think that's part of getting the nation talking and then making a decision and then knowing when it's time to move. And the point is, obviously, we have to move now. Second area is the area of quality, and a lot of people have raised that it's not enough to just get access. It needs to be access and throughput, which means access and quality. I've spoken about Model Cs. I think we've spoken a bit about achievement. But I think particularly that it is the public schools. I mean, that's really where we need to look at public schools and universities. And again, as I say, quality is not something that, like maths quality, you know, people say we must bring in Zimbabweans or we must bring in Indian teachers. And I always say, yeah, there are things you can do in the short term like that. But you know, the Zimbabweans are going to go home tomorrow if there's a settlement in their country. And the Indians, we're going to bring them and all they speak is Gujarati. And now you want to put them in the middle of the Transkei. And you want to rely on the Eastern Cape Department to give them housing. And they can't, you know. So you're still going to have problems even if you manage to bring the math teachers out to get them. So, yeah, the question of quality is not an easy one. But I think it's absolutely the right one. And also, as I say, it's not a slogan thing. I don't buy into the thing of that our one member raised of the university is not entirely transformed. The curriculum is not entirely an African curriculum. That's why our children can't perform. Well, our children must perform within the boundaries of what they've got. Then they can change it. You know, so finding that balance around saying we don't have the quality we want, we're not where we want to be, but our children must strive to be the best. And then lastly, I think, Chairperson, that I think the point that everybody's made, it does need to be a whole package. I mean, that it needs to be a whole package without becoming so complicated that we can't, that we burden ourselves down. Will it cost money? Yes, it will cost money. I mean, if we just look at schools, I think there's a figure here just on the backlog, current backlog of about 153 billion rand. And, you know, we're just saying labs, computers, teachers deserve a staff room if we want teachers to be happy at school. I mean, we've all seen staff rooms like a table, and then in the background is all the textbooks because they don't want to give the textbooks to the children. And let me just say, incidentally, textbooks is a problem, Mr. Bonama, but it's not as much of a problem as we make out. It's probably 5%. Well, maybe that's something for the politicians to debate. It shouldn't even be 5%, but it's not 90%. 90% of the kids do get their things. And the point is that the bigger problem is that they don't use them, or one of the big problems is that they don't use it. So you sit with the textbooks in the back. You've got a microwave oven there so that the teacher can have a bit of food at lunchtime. And then you've got all the teachers sitting on a desk with a stick. And in this corner, they must do their marking and their paperwork, and they must counsel the students with all their gang-related and abuse-related problems. Teachers deserve a staff room, you know. And that's apart from the fact that if you're in a township school, you'll never have a swimming pool like I had at Westerford. You know, so how do we get around those things? So, yes, it will cost money. And similarly at universities, I mean, as we've seen, a NSFAS bursary, I mean, what do we do? Do we take the NSFAS 2 billion? Do we share it out and give everybody 45,000 rand a year? And then it's a much smaller number. At the moment, I think with our fees, somebody asked the question, I think it's about 30% of children are on NSFAS bursaries or on bursaries, which is quite high, actually. You know, so at least the bottom band is getting funded. We know that there are a lot of lower middle class kids who are not getting access because they don't qualify for NSFAS bursaries. And that's also a problem. But yes, it will cost money. But two things. I mean, one is we're going to have to make the choices. So there's a real choice. Do we give more money to NSFAS bursaries and tell them they don't have to pay back and they can live as they like and they don't even have to pass because the university is not transformed? And we take it away from basic school. We take it away from early childhood development. And those are the choices we do have to make as a nation. Where do we put our money? I do believe that as South Africans, if we got it right, if we got the debate right, if we got the energy right, if we got that sense of education as the number one national priority, which is happening more and more, I think South Africans would be prepared to spend more money. I really do believe that even white parents in their Model C schools, if you said to them, pay 5% more on fees and use that to get poor kids in, if they knew it was going to go to education and wasn't going to get eaten up somewhere else, they would be prepared to pay it. And so that's why we have to get the whole package right. I'm not prepared to put money into higher taxes if I know that in the Eastern Cape, hundreds of millions of rand of school feeding money has been eaten by civil servants. Not one of them has been charged. I mean, maybe that's something committees like this could actually ask much more tightly. Why? We know who they are. We know who the officials are. The Auditor General has identified hundreds of millions of rands of school feeding money, of money out of the mouths of children, and we let it happen. And then we're surprised by teachers say, you want me in class, and you can't even supervise your own funds. Every single education department, there's our ex-minister, every single education department virtually gets a qualified audit every year. They don't know where their funds are going. And so even the departments don't supervise themselves, and then they want to supervise teachers. So So I think that that's why we say it, you know, it needs to be a stakeholder and a citizen-driven process, because we need to get both government and teachers on board. It's all the levels together. And I think, just lastly, Chairperson, I think that question of accountability systems probably is the big issue of the day. I mean, that's why the presidency is talking about monitoring systems and why it's so important. How do we, as a nation, acknowledge the fact that we've had great policies, but they're not hitting the ground? Maybe just a last point on the CETAs. I mean, yes, I think some CETAs are working. Maybe that's something that this committee would want to look at in depth. I mean, I could give a quick answer. I can give you my personal opinions. My personal opinions are that maybe three of the CETAs are working, and why are we paying so much money for the rest of them? My personal opinion is that with the qualifications process, we started at the wrong end. That there are two ways of getting quality. So one is to say you're going to set up a quality council, and it's going to do unit standards, and everybody must meet those unit standards. And what we've seen happen in the process is that real educationists struggle and spend a lot of time on paperwork and can't get through the system. The other way is to say we're going to put a lot of energy into support on the ground and make sure that people can teach better, that they attend the courses, that they understand things, and then they work towards the standards. So it's starting at different ends, it's not to say. So, you know, I mean, again, if I had a choice, I would say that the SAQA process hasn't worked and the NQF process hasn't worked, and maybe we need to limit what they do and make it much less bureaucratic, you know, and I don't know what the solution is, and I think a committee like this could usefully investigate qualifications processes and the CETAs. And I mean, of course, we know that artisanships, I mean, we used to produce, what was it, 50,000 artisans, and now we produce 7,000 a year or something like that. So what happened there, you know, and why are we not doing that? And the very last point, Chairperson, I think one of the important points that people have made here is that while we're getting gloomy and while we're getting realistic and while we are saying a lot of things are not working, I find one of the terrible things that happens is that we undermine the achievements of kids who are getting somewhere. And probably, I mean, where's Anele? You know, Anele got these documents in place. He's got the stuff up here. He's doing a great job. He's come through a school somewhere. I don't know which school he went to. But, you know, are we really going to keep on saying he hasn't got experience, he hasn't got 25 years of experience, and therefore he's not good enough to be a parliamentary? You know, and so I think we undermine our young people who actually are out there doing things. Or we say that everybody, every black person at university is an affirmative action appointment. And I've heard white lecturers say this. And you come on and say, but hang on a second, I can point to you 30 white lecturers who are actually very mediocre and not very good. And as you've pointed out, there are many black lecturers who've really struggled to get there, and the fact that they're there shows that they are top of the pile. But somehow we need to cut through that and sort of on the one hand say, you know, so we need to acknowledge the excellence that is there. But on the other hand, say it doesn't help to just take the best genome investigators and assume that you can simply put Anele there. You know, and so how do we find that? How do we find that balance? Because we are a transitional society. We both have the impact of apartheid, and we have responsibility, as people have noticed. And I think part of that is that we need to understand a learning nation in which excellence is valued, in which we really strive to be the best that we can, and that's the task we set for ourselves. And in doing that, we praise people who are excellent, and we don't put up with mediocrity. Because we have to get it right for our future generations. Thank you, Chair. There are lots of individual questions I could come back to if people want me to. But
thank you. Thanks for a thought-provoking response that obviously would have elicited also a response. And I've noted, and I'm not going to allow people to make long inputs, but I think very sharp. And I'm specifically looking at you, Hadebe. So that we give Mr. Hadebe the opportunity, and if there's any, yeah, and then we'll be able to bring it to a close. Graham, I would want to spend a few minutes on what is the possible relation between the Development Bank of South Africa and the education desk there and Parliament. So I just want to think about that. It's really a question. is there a possibility of a partnership? You do have partnership with government, with departments, with civil society. What is the partnership with parliament? And is there a possibility to use some of your expertise under your unit in an engagement? We are struggling with the issue about the president has indicated that we have to become an activist parliament. What does that mean? We are trying to define that in our own little way. And it's clearly something of basic putting legislation in place to where do you stop your boundaries when it comes to implementation. There's something there. And how do we define it? So just that relational aspect. Or is there a, or am I making a wrong assumption? Is there already a very strong relation, because I'm coming from a provincial government. I was not in a national assembly up to now. Khadebe?
Thanks, Chair. I'll just keep it short, Chair. Now, it is a fact that we need to deal with the issues of corruption. And I believe that this committee will be able to do a strong assessment and ensure that the issue of the feeding scheme corruption is dealt with. This committee is here to make sure that all other bad images that have been created before are dealt with. So, but my concern, really, I don't find it giving sense that NSFAS will also move up to an extent of charging interest. I don't say surely they mustn't pay back the money that they've received from NSFAS. But I don't find it making sense that they must pay, I mean, that interest. It doesn't give any sense. Because, I mean, from your perspective of understanding, you know, it's not my fault that I've managed to study hardly and, you know, with that NSFAS, and I've managed to rise up to the bourgeoisie level. It's not my fault. But surely, maybe what you need to ensure is that we must instill, you know, if you go to these other companies, like for instance, ESCOM, when it gives you a bursary, it will tell you that the way you're going to pay back that bursary is that you have to go and contribute back to that company for certain capacity. Maybe that's one of the other systems that you must be able to use to say, after this, we must place that person where and how am I supposed to contribute back to, you know, in terms of paying those interests, you must pay in that way rather than paying, because, you know, paying is the money. It doesn't make any sense, because it really gives us very difficult time to, because as well, after you've got those qualifications, it's very difficult that you can get a job after those qualifications that day. So you must also find a way. I really don't support it. And for the fact that, say, a poor young man there, after getting whatever bursary, before he gets a job, he knows that there's a pile up lot of outstanding debt that he must pay. And at the other end, this side, he's got his family that he must also support. Because you must remember, at the end of the day, we find out that this young chap, he must support his brothers and sisters. They don't have family. So we must be able to also deal with that. Lastly, Chair, the issue of the school of middle seas. Honestly speaking, the issue that happens in MLO World School, that was outrageous. It can't be accepted in anyhow. You can't expect, you know, if we're saying schools that are Model C, they must also have this racial integration. Why should they have to be stubborn and stick into Afrikaner medium of instruction? It can't. If we say all schools, they must have a standard of operation, it must be that. Why should we create two separate operations? It can't be. So what I'm saying is that, irrespective, we're not saying Model C, they must go to the location or whatsoever. But you must say, at least they must find these imbalances. We must be able to also incorporate these levels, so that we can be able to say, all our young people, they must be able to, because those Model C schools, they've got more resources than any other schools. So
So how do you ensure that at least they assist other the location schools to come, the public schools to come at least have sporting days there and have at least this, you know, because that's one of the intention. Yes.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Ms. Lachetra.
Thank you. I thought I must seize this opportunity and know better about the DBSA. It's a beautiful name that develops the bank that gives students money to study. I want to find out actually a little bit who you are, your organogram, your list of vacancies. Unemployment is so high, poverty and inequalities are getting worse every day. Around more than 3 million dropouts between the age of 18 and 24 are joining protest march all over the country. What are you doing in this regard to deal with this matter? Thanks.
Okay, that will be another presentation. I think we'll possibly be dealing with that then in a different context as well, because I think this was really focused on the roadmap that they've presented, Ms. Lachetra, based on a call for a reflection on education in this country. And the Development Bank of South Africa was able to pull all that together. Now, you raised it up front in the introduction, and I think you did not come. Honorable Member Mangena, I can see in the handwriting that you feel very guilty. but we do understand. The member did indicate that he's involved with WIPS forum meeting. And that he is pressurized. So we do understand, and we'll talk. We'll talk to make sure that we find. I think the fortunate part from this committee, we've sent out already in advance the dates and the times of meetings, and we're trying to honor that. But if there's any requests or any discussion that we need to have, let's do that. Over to you, Grant.
Okay. Honorable Mangena will know that we spent some time in Soshanguve schools and out in Mpumalanga running a reading competition around Africa's 100 best books. And the schools that won were actually in the deep rural areas. And their teachers, they had to form groups of students with teachers who supported them. And the energy and commitment was fabulous. So, I mean, those things can be achieved. I think it speaks to our relationship with the committee, which I'll talk about, but the fact that I can come here and cry about the school feeding things, which you can see is one of the things that just breaks my heart, that we steal food from children. The fact that I can come and cry to a committee like this and hear that the committee will take it up makes me very happy, and I think that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Look, the NISFAS thing, I agree, and I think there are ways and there must be a discussion. But let me just say, I don't know, I'm part of the 1976 generation. I could be making my fortune. I can assure you there's not a big fortune in education. I could be running my own businesses and so on. And somehow we had a spirit of that we needed to serve the nation. And maybe that's the issue of children of today. They want to get their university degrees. Most of them will get jobs. There's some graduate unemployment, but most will get very high-paying jobs. And they want to then forget where they come from. Maybe they'll move their parents into a nice house. But how do we deal with that? That's all I'm asking the question of national service. And similarly on Model C schools, I mean, I agree with you, there's some things one cannot accept that go on in Model Cs, but we mustn't tar the brush. And we certainly must accept that there is a spot of excellence that does go on in the Model C schools. And how do we get them to do more than just charity? Because we don't want them to just share their resources occasionally over the weekends. We want to know that it's part of the whole process of sharing. And maybe, can I just say, I do tackle some of those issues in my book, In the Toxic Mix. I actually spend quite a lot of time trying to challenge the Model C schools to do more. And I think you're right. Just on the bank, I mean, I won't answer the question, but we are largely an infrastructure bank. And we work mostly with municipalities laying out electricity and water and things like that. And we've managed to convince the bank that education is one of those infrastructures that are really crucial. And because we're always trying to put in place water, we discover there aren't enough engineers. And we realize one of the reasons there aren't enough skills in the country is because of the basic education system. So the logic is very straight for the bank, development bank, to why we are involved in primary, you know, talking about primary schooling. Because it just impacts right through the system, and it's not going to be fixed quickly, and we need to build it into our plans. So if we don't have great plans for huge infrastructure development, and we don't know where the skills are going to come from. So maybe that relates to the question, yes, Chairperson, we would very much value a stronger relationship with your subcommittee, and I think today hopefully is the beginning of that process. We do talk a lot to policy. That's one of the interventions we make, is increasingly to talk about policy and the problems of our schools. And I think what we said today is nothing new, but saying it over and over again and putting it on the agenda over and over again reminds South Africans of what our tasks are. And if we can help this committee do that, I think that would be something. As I said, we are engaged in a series of four conversations around the country, and maybe that's something we could usefully do with a parliamentary committee in an ongoing way. I think of the poverty hearings that happened last year around the country, and maybe it wouldn't just be DBSA, it would be a number of other NGOs, something like Sengoko, the NGO Coalition or something, or Archbishop, or the churches and the subcommittee could maybe usefully hear from teachers and students themselves on the coalface as to what some of these problems are that we're talking about and why they're not in class. And also they can hear what, in turn, what the Parliament expects. So maybe that's a conversation one could pick up on and take further. Let me just say that the DBSA belongs to you as Parliament. It's owned by the Treasury. It's a government organization. And it's funded by you, by taxpayers' money, ultimately, and then what we get back from interest on our loans. So Parliament has also told us that we need to charge interest. And that's one of our difficulties in working with poorer schools. How do we find that? So you need to talk to Treasury about that. But in principle, I must just say that we don't have a unit. We have myself. I am the unit for education. So if you're able to convince Parliament that there should be a bigger unit for education, I'm sure we could put more support to you on that. But no interest at all. But we do see ourselves as contributing to the national debate. And then, as we said, directly working with some of the MECs, we have limited capacity. So we said, can we at least get engaged with one or two school districts? And we've done both the Western Cape, where we know there's a DA leadership, and Gauteng, where there's an ANC leadership, when we're looking at another rural province. We're just saying, are there a couple of districts where we could help identify this package and help put it in place? So I think there are a range of interventions, Chairperson, but we would really value a better link with parliamentarians, especially when new people are clearly engaging with the issues in a really forceful way. No, we are talking. You know, one of the problems, and maybe it's not a problem, and maybe this is too political, is that the DA provinces move a lot faster than the ANC provinces. And I'm being, maybe that's something you want to talk about yourself. I have written to a number of the ANC provinces, and it's very hard to get answers. And I've also written to the ministers, and it's very hard to get their officers to respond. If I see Bladen Zimande at a conference, I can shake his hand and talk to him. But when I write a letter, it just gets lost in the system. So I think we need to jack up on those things if you want us as a bank to be able to offer our help.
With that, I hope the parliamentary is an officer for Bladen Zimande. That's it. On your left behind you, I'm great. I've taken notes.
So, Chair, one last thing is you did mention a roadmap for skills, and that may be something that the DBSA could also play a role in. We're talking to the HSRC, and maybe jointly with Parliament, we could pull together a process that brings together stakeholders and says, what are the problems of the CETAs and the qualifications?
Thank you. No, thanks a lot. Can we really thank Mr. Block then for
can we make sure that we get the book is coming out? I'm talking of buying. I'm good at buying. I want to know when.
Thank you. No, I think it's the 1st of September. That's what he said. He did say that. Yeah.
If your committee's got spare money, I would love you to buy one for each of the members.
Okay, that's Anneli's in charge of that process. So, but what we are then saying is we will definitely look into that. But let's say to Graham, thank you. Just the roadmap and the thoughts around it. I can safely assume that we are all comfortable to say that we've appreciated the perspective, and that is a shared perspective, and there's different nuances, and Emma George raised a little bit of a different nuance in it, but not saying that it's those extremes and the contradictions all into that analysis. So we will minute it in that way that we were able to appreciate it and broadly subscribe to the perspectives that came from it. And there would be a little bit of variations, obviously. That's one. Secondly, I think we should say that the roadmap on education, Graham, speaks to the schooling system on predominantly schools. We are higher education and training. And therefore, a lot of the issues primarily will not be dealt with in this portfolio committee. However, it's got implications on our committee. And that therefore there is a need on what we can define as a roadmap on skilling. And I think you've suggested even a way of participation. And if members are comfortable, we'll be possibly able to draw up a proposal that links our parliament and our committee in particular with the DBSA and whatever other stakeholders and civil society is there to start a debate on that. Let me just indicate members too. So can we agree that that is possibly something practical to take up? There was a study done in June of 2009, Dr. Papier, FET Institute Western Cape, getting the right learners into the right program. An investigation into factors that contributed to the poor performance of FET college learners in NCF 2 and 3 programs in 2007, 2008. But just to give you an analysis now, this is Western Cape FET colleges. And if you look at the national average, it's always a little bit above the national average and a little bit above other institutions. Total learners who wrote exams in all programs, this is 2007 NCF level. It was 3,102. Number of learners certificated, 20%. Number of learners not certificated, 80%. And then it goes into IT, for example, number certificated in IT is 2%. In 2008, total enrolled learners in all programs at all colleges, this is Western Cape, right? On particular categories now, 4,896, absent or dropped out 26%, number of learners passed 23%. And then it went up for IT a little bit to 10%, from 2% to 10%. Now this is the reality when it comes to even, remember Minister Zemandi asked the question about the 16-year-old to 24-year-old, and how do we... And a lot of that, the post-schooling stage, will have to go in further education because they can't go to the universities. Now, this is the type of results that we're having in skilling our nation at the level of those respective institutions as well. Clearly, there is a problem. And it doesn't mean the problem lies with the institution. There's, again, the knock-on effect when it comes to basic education and the range of other realities. But very interesting, in this document... And I'll make sure that we get copies of it. There was questions asked to learners as well as to educators.
on particularly revealing where high school respondents' views on who should attend FET colleges. So there's a mindset issue here. According to principal and teachers, these should be those who are not coping with academic courses, for example. Students not well suited to high school. Learners who do not plan to go to further education institutions or higher education institutions. Where learners were not coping with the demands of the curriculum. Dropouts. So what you then do in school, you say, no, you know, you're not a real academic student. So rather we're going to take you out here and put you into an FET. Even the perspective from educators at basic education of teachers of what FETs are all about is a complete misplacement. And in a sense, sending the kids that they feel have this ill discipline, send them to FETs. Now, FETs are supposed to. In the IA, I see in one of your documents, you speak about in South Africa around about 30 out of 100,000, 35 out of 100,000 will pass for engineers as engineers of your population. In Australia, I think, is a number of 225 or 325 in the US. It's in the documentation, in your documentation. Now, there is a level between that high institution or the engineer and the kind of FETs where you require the type of apprenticeship and artisanal skill. And what we are lacking, therefore, is if we are just sending children, that in a sense a teacher feel this is the problem child in the class and therefore we suggest rather go to FET, you're going to have a negative implication based on the skilling of our nation and what we define as the skilled revolution. So there is a deep debate around that. What I will do is to send this documentation also to members. And we then will, out of this meeting, we are agreeing to take up very practically the three issues around the implications and how do we can to engage on a public debate on a roadmap for skills and possibly have a joint part or a partnership between ourselves and DBSA around this matter. With that, Graham, thanks a lot. I would want to ask the members just to stay on for 5 minutes later. Just 5 minutes max, so that we can just deal with the other business. Thanks a lot, Graham. Members, can we then just look at the Anila has given us the minutes of the 10th of July. Now you recall we had the recess, and therefore we did not necessarily, and also at the strat plan we didn't look at this particular minutes. But it's essentially dealing with the consideration of the committee program. You would recall it was a very short meeting. We presented the program and members made suggestions and input into that. Can we adopt this minute?
Yeah.
Mishwana?
Yes. Who is it?
Member Mishwana?
Okay, thanks. I love you. I love
him.
I move for adoption of the minute.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your support. Members can remember we did indicate that in that meeting we should try and go out and engage the various sectors like the DVSA or any other research institution to see how we can capacitate and give support to that. I will be asking people not to forget that particular point. And if you are therefore ready to come forward with a proposal and around it. I do think we've got a capacity constraint when it comes to deep research analysis. And how do we, a lot of the stuff that we are doing here, how do we ensure that we pitch it at the right level beyond our engagement? All these critical points that you are making in our reporting format as well as in recommendations that we are taking forward. And I can't keep it to one individual. It's Anele. There's a whole media focus on it. There's a strategy of how do we roll it out. If a member raised something of a constituency in this committee, a very burning issue, we are noting it, but what is the follow through on it? And it can't always be the member because it's then educational issues. And how do we then link from here up with the relevant authorities to make sure that we... And then come back in a month or two's time and say we were able to deal with it. So the issue of capacity becomes a real issue. I also think, and I've said it in our own... in the chairs of the meeting with all the chairs, it's a bit mind-boggling for me that members of parliament, we have this shared, and we are better off as chairs, and the whips are possibly better off, but members generally, I think as two or three members sharing one secretary, for example. So those are things that I think we want to see in what way can we, because we are dealing with higher education. Is there a possibility of this committee striking a partnership relation around internship with institutions to capacitate Parliament and give support to Parliament without this committee's money? It's just the way you strike relations and partnerships. Mm. I'm raising that there because I think there is a wealth of expertise in this room that would be able to unlock some of that, and I'm just advancing that. If you can remember the debate that we had on this issue. So apart from passing the minutes. Then, Anele, you've also given the report, the draft report. Next week, we are meeting the 26th. This is the draft report out of the workshop. We will be meeting next week, and we need to... The data is still the same. The 28th, we are supposed to have to present our plan with the strategic issues. So somehow we were able to go through the workshop, but also all the meetings and the briefings that we had, we'll have to package a document related to our strategic plan for the next couple of years. Not necessarily speaking to every little bit of detail because we had just 2 or 3 weeks out of it. It will remain a process. I remember I've given you a note of one of our members. Did you incorporate that into it? I think I at least had 2 comments, and I've passed it on. Dr. Jones?
I've got comments on this document. Shall I hand it to you and Nelly separately?
Okay. So what we are asking is members, you had an initial, I think, look at it, and this is a further one. If there's any input that you want to make, either go and speak to Nelly so that he can write down, alternatively, just write a note and just pass it on to him. What we will then do is, before the meeting, a day before the meeting, we'll sit and then present it to yourself. Was there a framework given out by your management, the administration, around the framework of the document to be submitted? Okay. So we'll have to look at the framework, the structure of the report, etc. But there is no guideline, it seems to me. So Dennis is pulling it together. Whoop, are you comfortable? Are we leaving anything out under your instructions?
No.
Good. With that, members, thanks a lot.
Thank you.